I'd like to speak this morning about the use of biodiversity to link agricultural productivity with environmental quality, with special reference to three experiments I've been involved in Iowa. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors here, Matt Helmers, Lisa Schulte Moore, and Craig Chase. I'd also like to acknowledge a number of other co-workers, former students, postdocs, and some funding agencies that have made these longer-term projects possible. All right, so the subject of this morning's talk is Iowa, which has one of the most altered landscapes in the United States. The top map is Iowa as it was found by people mapping it in the 1850s. And the tan area is prairie. The green area is forest, and much of it is riparian forest. And then there's some purple areas that are up in the north-central part of the state that are wetlands. But you notice that all that perennial vegetation covered the entire surface of the state. So the bottom is a representation of 1990s. The gray area is cropland, and the tan area is pasture land. There's a very small amount of riparian vegetation. If you dig into one of Iowa's 99 counties, this is what you find. This is from the land cover data provided by the National Ag Statistics Service, the cropland data layer. Yellow is corn. Green is soybean. You see a couple of towns. The blue is a couple of lakes, small lakes. And that green line is riparian vegetation along one of the water courses. So 63% of the state's surface area now, of a land area of about 160,000 square kilometers, is in two plant species. So that it's represents a huge reduction in biodiversity, obviously, but also big changes in how the ecosystem functions. This didn't just happen by some random process. People chose to do this. So in the same way that they cleared the prairie and the savanna and the forest and drained the wetlands, they also changed the crop system. So starting in the 1950s, as shown by this graph put together by Jerry Hatfield at the ARS lab in Ames, we went from a system that had more crops on the landscape to fewer. And basically what happened was small grains, alfalfa and other hay crops, were replaced by an increasing acreage of soybean. So that green and yellow pattern I showed you in the previous slide was the result of consciously taking other crops out of the landscape and concentrating on the production of corn and soy, which do exceptionally well in Iowa, but imply big changes in the types of ecosystem services that are provided. So what are some of the consequences of changing this diversity in crop and non-crop vegetation? One is that in Iowa and throughout the central corn belt, we have substantial nitrogen emissions to surface waters that are basically proportional to the amount of fertilizer applied and to the amount of land surface area that's in row crops. We also see frequent detection of pesticides, especially herbicides, in surface waters, and these are reflecting patterns of use. When things come into the market or when they're removed from the market, we see a signal in the surface water. We've seen now quite a pattern of herbicide resistance in weeds. This is now being expressed most notably in the evolution of glyphosate resistance in many weeds. And we also see that soil erosion remains a serious problem. And this is expected to get worse as changes in climate result in a higher frequency of high-intensity events, such as what we had in 2008, when 2.5 million acres of Iowa farmland lost more than 20 tons of soil per acre in the flooding. All right, so I'm going to talk about three experiments that are taking place in central Iowa to investigate how diversification with perennial vegetation affects agri-ecosystem performance. And one of them is a rotation study. One of them is a what I'll call a a science-based trial of row crops integrated with prairies, or STRIPS, and you can find that on the web under that name. And the last one will be a investigation of different biofuel systems that rely on corn or perennial vegetation. Okay, so the first one is addressing the question of whether diversifying corn and soybean systems with small grain and forage crops can reduce reliance on agrochemicals and fossil fuels while maintaining or improving productivity and profitability, with the idea being that if we can reduce our reliance on these inputs, we can probably see differences in the environmental load that these chemicals create. All right, this work is being done in Boone County. The experimental site is about 25 acres of land. The plots are laid out in four replicate blocks, with each phase of each rotation system present every year in each block, and the plot dimensions are 18 by 85 meters, which allow mid-sized farm machinery to be used. So there are three rotation systems here. There's a conventionally managed corn-soybean system. There's a three-year system that uses corn and soybean, but also oats and red clover, where the red clover is grown as a green manure crop. And then there's a four-year system where corn and soybean are supplemented with oats and alfalfa, where alfalfa is grown as a hay crop. And we apply some manure in the 3 and the 4 year systems before the corn is produced. So we apply this manure in the fall onto the forage land prior to incorporating the forage and then producing corn in the subsequent year. All right, this is a systems experiment. We use technology packages that differ between the different rotation systems. And briefly put, the two-year system, in the simplest comparisons I'm going to talk about today, uses a technical package of genetically engineered crops for glyphosate tolerance in the case of soybean and rootworm and borer resistance in the case of corn, and we use broadcast herbicides applied across the field at conventional rates. The 3 and the 4 year systems don't use genetically engineered genotypes in this simple comparison I'm going to talk about today. And they use banded herbicides in the corn and soybean years with cultivation between the rows. So these post-emergence products applied at low rates coupled with banding and inter-row cultivation allow much lower rates of herbicide to be applied. All right, so as I mentioned before, we cultivate and band herbicides in the corn and soybean years, but we also have some other things going on that contribute to the reduction in herbicide load in the 3 and 4 year more diverse rotations. Basically, we have cultural practices like mowing and clipping that take place in the forage years and the small grain years, but also we have asynchronous harvests or a disruption of the weed life cycle because we have spring-planted crops with later maturing crops, and that interferes with the ability of the weeds to set seeds. All right, so what have we seen? First of all, very large reductions in nitrogen and herbicide inputs have been possible. So you see here the input levels in the three rotation systems between 2003 and 2010, and the averages over that 8 year period are shown on the bottom. You can see that there's been a big reduction in the average nitrogen use in the 2 year, 76 down to 12 kilos of N per hectare per year. And the herbicides over that 8 year period have dropped between the 2 year system at 1.91 kilos active ingredient per hectare per year down to 0.21. And actually, in the last 5 years, as you can see on the right hand graph, the inputs of herbicides are on the order of grams per hectare in the 3 and the 4 year systems. They're not organic systems. We do use products, but they're used at very low rates. This is a graph of some work we did analyzing fossil energy inputs. Basically, the majority of fossil energy inputs in these systems go into corn. We use gas to dry the corn grain in wet falls, and we also use quite a bit of gas embodied in the form of nitrogen fertilizer. The longer-term rotations, because they use less fertilizer and they have less corn, use on a per hectare per year basis considerably less fossil energy. All right, so what about the characteristics of these systems with regard to yields and profitability? Corn yields are statistically higher despite the reduction in the 3 and the 4 year rotations of herbicide and fertilizer inputs. So we're seeing a rotation effect here despite lower inputs. Soybean yields are similarly higher. Net returns for the whole rotation system, this is when you average it over all years within the system, are statistically equivalent in all the systems over that period of 2003 through 2010, although it does require more labor to run the longer rotations. And that labor comes in the form of time to spread manure and to make hay and things like that. So we cost account the labor in our estimates of net returns, but even so, it's a very small amount of labor per year. Weed suppression has been highly effective in all the systems. The y-axis represents the percentage of total crop harvested material that weed biomass constitutes, and you can see that those numbers are tiny. They're on the order of several kilos of weed dry matter per hectare in the corn and the soybean years, which are very hard to find. We have very effective weed control. We do get some growth of weeds in the stubble of the small grain crops, and occasionally if alfalfa suffers winter kill, we get some growth of weeds there. But those are also very low numbers. We soil sample in this experiment to look at the weed seed bank every fall after crops are harvested. We wash them through this machine. Normally the cover on that steel machine is down and a high-pressure wash system separates soil from weed seeds. And if you look at the trends over time, the weed seed numbers in all the rotation systems are going down. So weed control has been effective. The two-year system has the fewest weeds. The three-year system has the most. The four-year is intermediate. But note that the general trends in all these systems are going down. Biodiversity contributes to the control of weeds, particularly in the 3- and 4-year systems, by in the form of these seed predators. The two most common ones we have that consume weed seeds are the prairie deer mouse and this field cricket, which consume very large numbers of seeds. We can talk more about this later. We've had a number of publications that document the losses of seeds at different times of year and also their impact on weed population dynamics. The long and the short of the story is if you want to reduce herbicide use, it's very handy to have indigenous organisms out there consuming seeds that lie on the soil surface. They're not a complete biocontrol, but they contribute to the many little hammers that we need to get the job done. What other pest-related issues have we seen with regard to rotation? This is a slide taken last year. You see on the green side, the 3-year rotation soybeans, two varieties grown there. On the more brown side, you can see the 2-year rotation soybeans, two varieties grown there. And you can see the yields in bushels per acre. We have a disease caused by Fusarium fungus called sudden death syndrome, and the expression of that disease is very greatly affected by the rotation systems that we're in. So part of what we're seeing with regard to the rotation effect of soybean relates to the diversity within the rotation, and I'm working with a plant pathologist now to understand why the incidence and severity of this Fusarium differ between the rotation systems. We saw a similar expression of the disease this year, but not as intensely. Okay, another study that we call STRIPS, Strategic Trials of Row Crops Integrated with Prairie Systems. Can we put patches or strips of perennial vegetation into row crops like corn and soybean to gain disproportionate benefits with regard to conservation of soil water and biota? And this study is being done at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, which is the largest reconstructed tallgrass prairie in the United States, in Jasper County, just east of Des Moines. And this area is being converted from what is now in row crops back to tallgrass prairie in the period of time where the land is still in corn and soybeans. It's managed by conventional local farmers. And we work with the refuge to put strips of prairie and patches of prairie into watersheds that contain corn and soybean. So there are four treatments. I'll describe them here in these cartoons. We have all-crop watersheds, as shown in the lighter color, where the bottom of the watershed's at the bottom of the egg and the top of the watershed's at the top. And those crops are grown no-till, and then we have different proportions and different placements of prairie vegetation within those watersheds, either all at the bottom, forming 10% of the watershed, or in strips up the watershed on the contour at 10% or 20% of the watershed area. So all the crops are grown no-till, and the prairie vegetation was planted in 2007. So here's what one of those prairie conservation strips looks like in 2010, looking down from the top of one of those watersheds. You notice that unlike brome grass, which will lay flat under a heavy rain and allow soil sediment to be transported across the flattened grass, prairie vegetation has erect, stiff stems, which do a very good job of filtering water, slowing it down, increasing infiltration, and allowing sediment to drop on the upslope side of the strips. We have H flumes installed in each of these watersheds so that we can look at the amount of sediment and water moving out of the bottom of each watershed, and we can measure also the amount of nutrients in the water and in the sediment. So here you see 4 years of data starting 2007 through 2010. The top lines with the black dots represent the all-crop watersheds. 2007 was a relatively dry year. 2008 was a massive flood year coming in May and June when there was very little crop canopy cover, and you can see that there was about a 95% reduction in the amount of sediment coming out of the bottom of the watersheds in the stripped watersheds relative to the all-crop watershed. 2009, same pattern, but much lower magnitude. 2010, we had a very, very large amount of rain, 16 inches in the first 11 days of August. More crop canopy cover, but you see that the pattern is the same, about a 95% reduction in sediment being transported out of the bottom of the watersheds that are stripped relative to the all-crop watersheds. So the message here is that no-till is not enough in the new climate regime that we have. Just very briefly, we've done measures of plant biodiversity and bird biodiversity. We get about a five-fold increase of native plants in the watersheds where we have the strips relative to the all-crop watersheds. The increase is not surprising. What is heartening is the fact that a 10% change in land cover results in a more than 500% increase in the number of species. So a small amount of the watershed conversion to perennial cover gives a disproportionately large effect. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about biofuels. Those of you who are from the Midwest know that a very high percentage of our corn is now going to ethanol. In Iowa, I've heard a figure of on the order of 55 to 60% of this year's crop will go to an ethanol mill. Nationally, it's about 40%. Corn, like other annual species, has some limitations, as I tried to point out earlier. So what might we do to replace that feedstock with more environmentally benign feedstocks, in particular native perennial vegetation? So we have a systems called COBS experiment, which is in near Madrid, Iowa, in Boone County. And it is similarly sized to the one I showed you at the beginning. It's about 20 acres. Each of these plots is 27 by 61 meters. And we have five cropping systems, and PowerPoint is changed a little bit, the presentation, so it may be hard to read the last one. We have a corn-soybean system where grain is removed, but the residue remains. And then we have a continuous corn system, and we have two treatments, one in which most of the residue is removed, about half the stover is retained, but all the grain and about half the stover are hauled off. And then we have that same system with a rye cover crop. And then we have two prairie systems, which are hard to read on this slide, but one of them receives a dose of nitrogen fertilizer in April and the other one does not. And we haul the biomass off after frost. All right, so we have these five cropping systems in place. This experiment got going in 2008. It has a monitoring system for drainage water. Down the middle of each one of those plots, there's a tile that collects water. On the sides of the plots, there's a tile that is intended to prevent the movement of water side to side, plot to plot. And then these central tile lines are monitored for the quantity and quality of the water. So samples are drawn out in a flow proportional manner, and they're analyzed for what's in them, dissolved nutrients. Our interest is in evaluating the multiple performance criteria of these systems, and some of these criteria are shown here. I'm going to talk just about a few of them because I want to illustrate an idea that has become really apparent to me as I've worked with the data from this system. So here are three performance indicators, and we don't need to dwell on these numbers because I'm going to show a graph that makes it easier to see in just a minute. But I've calculated the amount of liquid fuel that could be produced from the grain of corn converted to ethanol or the grain of soybean converted to biodiesel, and I've expressed that in energy units on a per land area basis. And then my group has measured the amount of root mass to 1 meter depth, and about 40 to some percent of that is in carbon. In these different systems, we go out in the fall and haul soil samples back, and we wash them and calculate how much carbon and other nutrients is in the root mass. Then we've also, through the use of these tile drains and in the monitoring system we have in place, we've been able to look at nitrate loss. Okay, so here's the graph I want to talk a little bit about as a way to illustrate what I think we have to dwell on, which is there are trade-offs among these different ecosystem performance indicators, right? So you see that the corn-soybean grain system on the left, and then the continuous corn and continuous corn with a winter cover crop, fertilized prairie PF and prairie P. Well, if you go to prairie, you get essentially no nitrate leaking out of that system, regardless of whether you fertilize it. That PF system is pretty close to the P system. If you want to maximize the amount of liquid fuel produced, you go to the all-corn systems where you can convert the stover that you harvested as well as the grain. So that's the CC and CCW plots. If you want to maximize the amount of root carbon, you go to the unfertilized prairie plot, the P. But if you wanted to look at a system that produced more liquid fuel per unit land area than does the conventional corn-soybean cash grain system, and something that leaked very little nitrate into the soil and that had a pretty large amount of carbon being put into the soil, you might look at that PF system. So it's not the best necessarily in any of those performance indicators, but when we optimize the system to give us many ecosystem benefits, you begin to look at these kinds of trade-offs. And I think ultimately, if we're going to get serious about balancing production with ecosystem services, these are the kind of approaches we're going to have to take. Now, we can put economic values on those different services. There are a lot of different ways we could begin to approach it. But I think these are the hard questions we're going to have to look at. So in conclusion, I want to leave you with these ideas that annual crops are important, but perennial species in an area that was dominated by perennial grassland and forest, that those perennial species are needed to restore the health of landscapes and watersheds. They don't have to be imposed on the whole landscape. They need to be considered for strategic locations that can provide disproportionate benefits relative to the amount of land area that's converted. Increasing biodiversity can be a viable strategy for increasing cropping system resilience to things like high-intensity rainfall events, and for reducing reliance on synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, and fossil energy. Thank you for your attention.
Very good. Thank you, Matt. Mm-hmm. If you have questions for Matt, Michelle.
You showed the cartoon with the 10 and 20% perennials. And you call it a strategic approach. So the cartoons are simplified, obviously. Did you put those strips in a pattern that's similar to your cartoons, or was it more?
So the number of strips will vary with the length of the watershed from top to bottom. The distance between the strips has to be compatible with the spring boom and the planting and harvesting equipment. So there was some adjustments for each watershed. So some of them have two, some of them have three strips, some of them have just one patch at the bottom.
Okay, so it's based on the farm equipment. Not
yeah,
the
so these watersheds range in size from about 1 to 8 acres each, and the length of the slope differs quite a bit. The slopes run up to about 8%. Yeah, Chuck.
Matt, putting all the 10% strategically in one spot would have some management advantages, obviously, but it would also concentrate all the junk in one place.
Yeah.
Is it better to disperse it three places?
It is, from the standpoint of restricting the movement of soil within the watershed. So we know from revised universal soil loss equation that the length and the steepness of the slope are important. Obviously, if you allow it to flow several hundred feet down before it hits a patch at the bottom, there's a lot more opportunity for soil to move within the field. So yeah, I think we would advocate strips. It's a trade-off, yeah. Doug.
Two questions. One, on the rotation system, were the corn and soybeans in the longer rotations versus the two-year rotations, were they near isogenic in terms of the Roundup Ready versus the non-Roundup Ready varieties for corn and soybean?
Okay, so the question is whether the corn and soybean genotypes we used were near isogenic between the two or the three rotation systems. So I'm going to answer that in two ways. First of all, to address whether rotations have the same effect on the same genotype, we've split the plots over the last 4 years. So we've actually done the genetically engineered and non-genetically engineered corn genotypes and soybean genotypes side by side in all the rotations. And the short answer to the question of whether rotation effects are genotype dependent is rotation effects are expressed for both genetically engineered and non-genetically engineered genotypes.